departure from academia into the British Navy, the Burma Division of the British Navy. And in around 1910, the Rhodes Scholarship in terms of finance.
This is vaguely reminiscent of the background of Phillips, Phillips Curve, if you've ever read. Very similar. He was in the Navy and in World War II in the British Navy, and I can send you something.
Formerly meant for sterling area type expenditures, as in 1946, sterling was blocked. Got into Cambridge where I wanted to go, but they said the waiting period of 3 US consulate steps in. Think you're blocked sterling. Give you dollars. Freeman was there. He was there when I arrived. Mm-hmm. And clearly, an important personage. I was attracted to Chicago by names like Frank Knight. I did pick Chicago.
When you wrote your book, 1975, I guess, I'm talking about overview of monetary policy.
A sort of
a paperback.
A paperback, yeah. Meant for the layman kind of thing.
Yeah.
The anxious economy.
I wouldn't exactly call it a layman's book.
A lot of the portable Stanford seed.
Yeah. When you wrote that book, the quantity theory ideas, were you going all the way back to Friedman? Or those ideas?
University of Rangoon was, you could call it a hive of conservative economists, strangely enough.
So they had the Cambridge kind of...
Oh, no. The professor, sort of intellectual parentage was von Mises, Hayek, mm-hmm. and things like that. The other teachers were there, or quantity theorists, essentially. I thought the University of Chicago did too little on Keynes. It wasn't a single course in which Keynes was used as a textbook.
That's when I went there in the 60s, so I don't know what happened. So, Friedman was brought there to teach Viner's price theory course. Did you take price theory from Friedman?
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. And then, but he only did a workshop in money, right?
That's right. A main person teaching money.
Lloyd Mintz?
Lloyd Mintz.
Yeah, his work has a very kind of monetarist sound to it. So they must have interacted. He and Friedman must have.
Yes, actually they did. Mintz did the main course that you might call money. Mm-hmm. There was nobody there capable of teaching, call it fiscal, or very little of that. There was people very much involved with this price theory. Workshop and money, as you say. Mm-hmm. I'm money from this. Mm-hmm. And Lloyd Metzler came.
Did you know Marshall Kaplan? I remember you.
Yes. Too.
So then, you were in academia for the entire time before you went to the Council of Economic Advisors?
I taught at Chicago in the business school.
In what years? So how did you end up on
the Ford Foundation had endowed underdeveloped countries and given my years of training at Stanford. And I was running that for 7 years, then got tired of administration, was teaching full time. When I got a call from Paul McCracken.
Did you talk to the president before you became a member of the council?
Yes, I had met Mr. Nixon. As a member of the Hunt Commission, if you remember the commission, and I was a member of that. And
right.
In connection with that, I had met and talked to the president.
So McCracken knew your views through your writings or professionally? Had you known him before?
Yeah, we crossed paths. We both taught in a kind of summer course for life insurance officers that was run by the University of Chicago. Life Officers Insurance Seminar, it was called, before it became the American Life Convention. Paul used to teach in that night.
So you were brought in for your expertise on financial matters primarily?
Yes. As a matter of fact, Paul's first call had to do with giving them a hand writing a chapter on all of the corporate finance end of things that had taken place in 1970. the liquidity problems of the corporations. And then I got to know Paul a little better. I'd go and, how do you put it, just sort of visit council, read stuff, redo it, and helping him almost as a member of the staff. And then when Hautacker left, Paul called me to join the council. George Childs was there, wasn't at that time.
When?
George and I were old friends.
When did Hautacker leave?
He left about January, February 71. About that time.
So, when did you actually arrive in Washington?
You know, it's kind of strange. I arrived in Washington about March
of 71.
But I was stupidly concerned about the fact that Stanford was going to pay me till September. There was nothing I could do to prevent them paying me till September. You know, you get paid by the academic year.
Yeah.
I'd done my year's work in a sense. I'd had time off. But I said, I can't join the council full-time till September, because Stanford's going to be paying me all this time, and it looks like a conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, nobody could advise me on that. So I stayed on the council, receiving a sort of a per diem, which amounted to the same thing as my salary.
Mm-hmm.
So it was strange. I was sworn in, I think, in June, but the records show that I went on the council in September. I went on the payroll of the council in September, but I was there from the late March, and I worked teaching the spring quarter here anyway.
We'll get into this more, but Herb Stein obviously had very strong ideas on monetary policy. Did your ideas mesh? Did you find yourself arguing with him a lot? How did you get along with him?
I got along fine with Herb, except I was hooked on the idea that the biggest problem we faced was devaluation. And that was not a word mentioned, at least in White House circles. Again, talk about gatekeepers. I received through Paul the message from the gatekeeper. Mentioned devaluation again, you'll be back at Stanford.
So you had contact with Paul Volcker? Paul McCracken.
Paul McCracken.
But you are.
The Volcker was there.
Did you ever talk to him about these issues? Did you see things more sympathetically with him than with the Secretary of the Treasury at that time? It would have been Kennedy. It would have been Connally.
Kennedy had just left. I knew Kennedy quite well, from the past, from Chicago days. And John Connally had taken over the Treasury about that time. Volcker was, I think, undersecretary. The big problem was to get Volcker to suggest that by the time we fouled it up, and we really had fouled up the devaluation by, first of all, denying that we needed one, refusing to confront the fact that a change in the price of gold was necessary as part of the game also, quote, the American contribution, as the foreigners would refer to it. But they were right. We had to make some, quote, contribution to show that we were guilty. It wasn't France's problem, it was our problem. But obviously France had to move to give us the correction we needed. It was a very, very funny arrangement.
But that's not the way Connally and Burns wanted to package it. I have a very bizarre letter that Burns wrote to Nixon in the spring of 71 during the crisis, you know, when Germany floats and the pound's under attack.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears as though both Burns and Connally are competing to design how the crisis is going to occur, that they realize that devaluation will occur, and Burns wants to make it appear as though it's the fault of the French, so that he wants the Treasury to pay out gold in unlimited fashion, and to make it look like France forced us off the gold standard. And then when we're forced off, we can say, look, you know, we were forced into this. We didn't create this problem. It's France's fault. And then that will give us more leverage in getting a different burden sharing in defense arrangements and also in trade matters, which struck me, this seemed to be part of the problem, that Burns wanted to do all kinds of things that really weren't his province, that really weren't monetary policy.
This is one area where Arthur was out of his own depth. He didn't seem to understand international economics. He's a great business cycle scholar, but he would pontificate a great deal about this. He'd say things like, we'll be judged by what we leave the next generation. After all, the last generation had set up a wonderful system. We've enjoyed this wonderful system. What are we going to do about the next system that's going to...
Yeah, we'll talk more about Burns, but he... I'm going to talk to Friedman about Burns tomorrow, so we'll really get into this. But
George Stiglitz's crack about this is the most one. As you know, Burns would go abroad, go to Europe, whatever.
Yes.
And, George said, Milton fiddles while Burns roams. That's beautiful.
Okay, I have heard that, but I didn't know the source.
Stiglitz.
Sapphire reports that, but I didn't know that Stiglitz was the source. That sounds right.
Bill was a speechwriter there at the White House at that
time. Yeah.
Bill Sapphire.
Yeah, his little book is wonderful, Before the Fall, I think it's called. Burns didn't... He really wasn't a neoclassical economist, in that he didn't see the economic activity as coordinated by the price system. When he thought about markets, he thought about psychology and the psychology of the businessman and confidence. And so when it came to foreign exchange issues, he didn't think in terms of how price levels would change the real terms of trade in terms of a Viner-Friedman framework. He thought in terms of the psychology of the market and how the government could influence that. So he put forth proposals and ideas that to us seem almost naive. I think Nixon seemed to be viewing as naive too, like, you know, people... Nixon seemed to be much more hard-headed, like people follow their own self-interest. They don't, it's not psychology.
Nixon really very badly wanted to avoid the onus of the Republican devalued the dollar. It's like the Republicans teased FDR for having devalued the dollar, you know. Some stodgy Republicans did somehow blame FDR for that devaluation. And
well,
he wanted to avoid having that stigma attached to him and try to find every possible way to do it. I had given a speech in my last sort of seminar talk at the economics faculty at Stanford just before I left for Washington. It was on the subject of the need to devalue the dollar, that we had misbehaved as a country. We were the worst performing of the G7 in terms of inflation, even worse than Italy, I think. Having been the best in prior to 65.
Yes.
And if Brazil does that, everybody would forecast that Brazil has to devalue. But when the U.S. does it, nobody's going to even think about it. And indeed, old Dupre, who was, Emile Dupre, was the international man in the economics department, he got furious at me, almost choked. He was getting very ill by that time. How dare you say to devalue the dollar? Dollar is better than gold. Not only as good as gold, but better than gold.
Well, for 10 years, people had viewed the problem as a structural one that would go away. It was due because we had our troops abroad, and because there was too much foreign investment, and because their capital markets weren't has developed as ours, and because we were at a different phase of the business cycle, and for a long time, we forced other countries to inflate, to maintain.
Yeah,
And finally, they no longer were willing to do that. Of course, that's all in your book. It's a great discussion of that in the book we talked about. But what you say about Nixon's attitude toward devaluation makes sense. I mean, the conservative businessmen kind of look back to the Roosevelt era and the Depression, and they thought of monetary manipulations of Roosevelt as causing problems and confidence. And Burns apparently gave an impassioned plea not to close the gold window at the Camp David meeting August 15th, and presumably that reflected a similar sort of set of ideas.
It was like losing a war, devaluing. It's just something terrible. And in fact, the president got hold of the attorney general, the assistant attorney general, whose name I've forgotten now, he became a judge in the Chicago area, to write a memorandum saying that the president did not have the power to change the price of gold. Although every president had assumed that the president had the power to change the price of gold.
So who inspired that memo?
Nixon inspired the memo and got the Attorney General, the Assistant Attorney General, to write such a memo. And it was a long memo which said that when we signed the IMF Accords, which is a kind of a treaty, the Senate had included the clause saying that you have to consult Congress.
Of course, the real problem was, I think, the State Department, because for years we had promised our allies like Japan that it's okay, hold dollars, don't ask for gold, we're never going to devalue, and then we didn't want to do that to our own allies.
Which is true, devaluation.
So the State Department was just out of the question.
That's correct, no question about that. But the fact of the matter is that the Gold Standard Act of 1900 gave the president power. The big issue is whether an act of Congress overrides a treaty or vice versa.
So this must have been where Connolly came in, because Connolly realized that you could take the international issue and use it for political purposes. That is, labor had become increasingly protectionist, particularly with the penetration by the Japanese of the U.S. automobile market. So Connolly realized that you could take that protectionist animosity and package the devaluation as standing up to the foreigner, as doing something about the unfair trading system.
Surcharge idea.
Right, the investment tax credit where you could only buy. And Congress is, and that may have been, that probably was illegal, because Congress is supposed to be the one to impose taxes and change tariffs, and yet the president did it under the Trading with the Enemies Act.
Something like that.
Something from World War II that let him do anything. But that's a little bit reminiscent of the wage price controls, isn't it? Nixon had this conservative businessman's attitude that wage price controls were bad because they would involve a lot of meddling regulatory oversight, bureaucrats intruding into the affairs of the businessmen. So he had this conservative Republican antipathy toward controls. But Connolly was the one that told him, look, the businessmen, they want protection from labor. They're willing to put up with intrusive government control. If you can promise them that you'll offer them the certainty of not having to deal with militant labor. So, I mean, is it right that in both of these ways Connolly changed Nixon's attitude and showed him how he could package these as a politically potent...
I think Connolly was the dominant figure then. George Shultz was, of course, head of OMB at the time. Shultz began to play a big role after the August situation had been become a major company. The question was now, by how much we devalue. It comes right back in the question of devaluing the dollar, one way or the other, and I think that damn 10% surcharge gave the wrong impression that a 10% devaluation is all we needed. And Schultz's main argument was, let's float. Let's find out through the market system, not through negotiation. All of you lay hands off and let's see where the dollar settles and then we'll re-peg. Which was, I think, a good argument in terms of finding out, because the Japanese at that time, for sure, I was dealing with them pretty much because I happened to know them. And they would be shocked at the idea. They'd say, yes, America needs it. 360 is the wrong number, the yen, but maybe 345.
But you, this is a very good part of your book. I think that what you show is that, yes, in principle, Schultz was right, but in fact, these other countries were not ready to float. So what they tried to, they went to capital controls, they went to a dirty float, and so they ended up pumping up their money supplies, creating domestic inflation.
Oh boy,
and that created a world boom in 1973 that laid the groundwork for the OPEC oil price increase. So when OPEC raised the price of oil, in a world boom, they found the demand for oil very inelastic, and so they, so in a way, I mean, I agree with Schultz and I agree with Friedman, but it was naive in the sense that other governments weren't willing to let their currencies float freely. And reading the memos, maybe you can correct me on this, but I have a feeling that other governments perhaps were not quite as benighted as Schultz may have thought about this. They were very concerned about the protectionist pressures for protectionism in their own countries. And these leaders felt that if you went to a floating exchange rate that caused a sharp revaluation of their currencies, that would trigger protectionist pressures that they would have difficulty dealing with. So that
the Germans were willing to float, I think. In fact, they did.
Well, they were willing to float against the dollar, but they weren't willing to float in a way that revalued their currency dramatically against France.
Exactly. Exactly. That was the big hang-up there. France knew it was, Giscard d'Estaing knew he was sitting in the, you know, all you guys move. We're going to stay where we are. I mean, that was a threat you couldn't make more. That's where Paul Volcker came to his conclusion. It has to be settled by negotiations. By negotiation.
So you get the feeling in this period that the two key individuals that are doing the bargaining, the kind of, is Connolly on the one hand, who's saying, we can live with this surcharge forever. No hurry. You know, this is just fine. And the French saying, we're not going to move because we can impose capital controls. And then Japan and Germany getting caught and, you know, feeling like the whole thing is going to fall apart if they don't do something. So finally, Japan and Germany decide that, yeah, they've got to do something. And then I guess Nixon and Pompidou get together in the Azores Island. And they,
that famous 7.89%.
Yeah, which comes out of the, I suppose the State Department had something to do with that.
Kind of, I didn't think so.
No,
think
just kind of, let's get on with this.
1789. I don't know. But why 7.89 precisely? God alone knows. And Nixon came back.
Well,
he's this bunch over this.
But I think Nixon probably didn't have his economic advisors there with him, Paul Volcker and the others, telling him that wasn't enough, and because of international considerations. He was willing to compromise. He was willing to go along with it, because he still, you know, he still was having problems with the Vietnam War. He needed support.
Well, that's good.
was still, you know, the withdrawal wasn't going, the negotiations weren't going well at that point. That's my recollection.
I guess, you know, this is where the Alderman Ehrlichman crowd come in. They're very powerful people, believe me. They saw the whole thing politically.
Mm-hmm.
There was Boker who really wanted to play a central role by negotiating, and there was Connolly, a very powerful man, by the way, and a personality powerful.
Well, when people talk about Connolly, they say he had a sense of charisma.
Oh, definitely.
That he didn't have any principles of his own. Somebody told me that one of his favorite expressions was that I'll slice it and dice it any way you want me to, so I'll do whatever you want.
Sure.
But then when he would go out in front of the cameras, he had this sense of self-possession,
tremendous
sense of leadership. And I get the story, it must be right, that Nixon admired that.
Definitely. No question. Connolly in the saddle when he was present in the room.
And so Connolly became Treasury Secretary in early 71, February 71,
yes.
I suppose. And so
that's when Kennedy left and Connolly became.
And then through the Camp David period, then, I mean, ultimately it was, well, we'll get to this, but ultimately, given Connolly's dominance, wage and price controls were just a matter of time, it seems like.
Yeah. I was arguing, if you devalue, you're going to need a freeze on prices before everybody wants dinner to. Like, the Mexicans have the same problem every time Mexico devalues.
Because
labor wants an equivalent increase in wages, and you just create more inflation. Whereas you freeze things, you give people 3 months out of a 6 month freeze. People will think about it carefully before they do something stupid. You know, labor was quite militant in those days. Won a strike against General Motors, a long, long, painful strike. But the idea of wage and price controls following the freeze, I got dumb as hell and said so. And I got dressed down for that too, thinking, how naive can you be? You have a freeze, you've got to follow it with a long period of wage and price controls. I said, why?
Well, the argument that was that then prices jump up,
exactly.
And then that kicks off the inflationary psychology.
Prices wouldn't pop up.
Well, also the problem was that the freeze was such a political success.
Yes.
You got such a positive response from it, you couldn't, how could you give it up?
The original plan was I was arguing for a 6 month freeze followed by no wage and price controls. Other people were saying 3 month freeze, all the country can take. I said, no, it can take 6 months. And it doesn't have to. The old wage and price control guys were dragged out from World War II, and they all seemed to believe strongly that administered prices and wages for a long period was necessary.
Yeah.
This is where Herbstein got caught in the middle, as in his son, he's been. So intellectually, it was a vile thing to do, but you emotionally loved it. You know?
Yeah, well.
And that's a power.
Yeah. We'll talk more about him later. But so let's go back and let me ask you about some of these individuals. Some of them, of course, were important before you came. The Treasury never had the influence before Connolly that it had traditionally. Kennedy didn't have a persuasive, strong personality. Was that the problem?
Very nice, weak man.
Very religious, I understand.
Very religious. And indeed, the Troika meetings, this is before I arrived on the scene, the Troika meetings used to be held in a hotel room. Because in Washington, as you know, the unwritten rule is, if you come to my office when we meet, that shows the pecking order, very simple, which is true.
Sure.
And therefore, if the meetings were held at the Treasury, it would mean that the Treasury is the top dog. If the meetings were held at the Council, it means that the Council is top dog. Whatever. So they would meet in this goddamn hotel room. And Kennedy went along with that. After Connolly arrived in the scene, it was perfectly clear who was top dog. All the meetings were held in the Treasury. What they call T1 in those days. Three top people in Troika.
So Kennedy, how had he been chosen? Had he been active in Democratic politics?
Republican politics.
Sorry, Republican politics.
You know, I don't know. I just don't know. I was away from the scene after the 1868 election. My only contact with it was Schultz. Mm-hmm. Schultz had been asked to go as Secretary of Labor. Mm-hmm. And we discussed it at length. And he was here at the time in Stanford, in the think tank. And so my only contact with Washington was via Schultz. So I don't know just how Kennedy got selected. He was a banker.
The initial major decision in the Nixon administration was whether to support an extension of the tax surcharge, the 10% surcharge. So at that point, Nixon's main advisors would have been McCracken. How much access did McCracken have to the president?
Quite a bit. The president liked McCracken, mm-hmm. and he liked Stein. He liked the council, and it was that way. And I felt any time that one wanted to see him, one could. And he'd spend time talking seriously.
Did he have regularly scheduled meetings, or was it just when something came
up? It was ad hoc. But given the conditions of the times, of course, the meetings were much more frequent than mm-hmm. normally would be the case, and the exchange of memoranda would take place.
And McCracken just didn't want to leave academia for an extended period of time, so he came for 2 years and left? Or?
Paul was there,
I guess through 71.
He left in December 71.
Yeah.
He left in December 71. He's there 3 years. But I guess he was getting tired and wanted to get back to academia. And indeed, he had nothing to do with writing of the 72 report. He said, look, I'm leaving. I shouldn't be sitting here in December dictating to you guys. I'll go quietly and...
Is Kennedy still alive, do you know?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. He was a very, very nice man. Yeah. I can say that.
Yeah. What about other players at the Treasury? Charles Walker, did you know him?
Yeah, I knew Charles. Charles was very political, obviously. Yeah.
And that group was in favor of wage price controls from the very beginning, it appears. They seem to have the conservative businessmen idea that labor was out of control and they needed some way of restraining labor. So Romney, Kennedy, Walker, even Volcker, I think, were very early on sympathetic toward controls.
You know, I wouldn't say that. I think the idea of control began to emerge after the idea of a freeze had emerged.
Okay, incomes policy, aggressive jawboning, and in dealing with particular sectors like the construction industry.
The construction industry was being very uppity, no question about that. The demands were getting ridiculous. But state and local employees as well. They were scared that inflation is going to break out.
The GM strike, you mentioned that. That must have had some effect in changing attitudes.
I'm sure. I was not there at the time.
Because by early 1971, Paul McCracken is working with the Justice Department, with Mitchell, on a law for a special tribunal to try economic crimes, to try abuses of power, which seems, in the context of American government, a very sort of surprising idea, how you define an economic crime. Well, it's going to be concentration of power, and that seems rather an extreme idea for a conservative Republican. So there must have been, if he was at that point, there must have been a change in attitudes early on. Stein seems much more pragmatic, or maybe opportunistic, I think is rather the right word. In the memos, at least the ones dealing with monetary and Fed policy, which is the one I'm interested in, McCracken comes across as the good cop, the one who's the confidant of Arthur Burns and the close friend, and Stein comes across as the bad cop, the one who's aggressively pushing the administration and Nixon to crack down on the Fed and pursue higher money growth. And Stein doesn't seem to have. Stein seems to dislike controls and an incomes policy intellectually, but he very early on talks about using it as a way of trading with the Fed. Well, you know, we want higher money growth. If that's the price, if that's Burns' price, then, you know, let's talk about it. Does that sound right at all? That's the impression I get from the
Fed job now.
Yeah.
Anyway, Nixon comes along and says, this was when I was alone with him. God knows why or what I was doing there alone. We just talk about China. He knew I was from Burma, and he recounted the script of Burma. And what a memory that man had. I swear, Burmese name, individuals he had met.
He was very able guy.
Very able. And this was an unrehearsed meeting, so he couldn't have swatted up and said, you know, I'll learn three quick Burmese names and tell Solomon. Why would he do that anyway? And it was the end of that. He said, what do you think about the economy? I said, growth is still very slow. And he said, why don't you goose Arthur Burns? And I said, sir, why don't you goose Arthur Burns? And he said, he speaks only to me. And he raised his hand up, which I thought was very funny and an apt description of Arthur. You know, Arthur was a very pompous man. And we met fairly regularly. We had monthly luncheons with the Fed, McCracken and Stein, myself.
But Nixon didn't trust Burns, really. But Burns thought of himself as the counselor to the president.
Yeah.
That he had been Eisenhower's aide-de-camp, and that he had earned Nixon's loyalty in the 60s, and he always saw himself as kind of a fatherly counselor to the president. Like he had earned that.
Definitely.
That position.
That was his view.
But Nixon was suspicious of Burns. He didn't really trust him. So there was Burns just misjudged his relationship with Nixon.
You know, Burns would do things that were but Chesney Martin hadn't done, was come over to the White House and spend time with the president, in some sense sacrificing the, quote, independence of the Fed. But he would do that, and they would have meetings, one-on-one meetings, without anybody in the room.
Now, this gets into Burns's personality. I think there are two things. The second one probably be much more controversial. Burns had the old Mitchell MBER view of the business cycle, and he attached a lot of importance to the psychology of the businessman. And Burns thought that he had prevented the 53-54 recession from turning into a depression, and that what remained for him now was, since he had shown how you could eliminate the recession, or at least depression part of the business cycle, was to show how you could combine prosperity with low inflation. But to do that, given his view of how the world worked, government needed to be very proactive, and it needed to intervene in a wide variety of ways in the economy. So Burns not only wanted to be Fed chairman, he wanted to be Secretary of the Treasury, he wanted to be head of the Council of Economic Advisers, he wanted to manage and run and initiate a whole variety of government programs and activities. Fiscal policy, not only fiscal policy with respect to taxes and the deficit, but investment tax credit, specific kinds of intervention. And to do that, he had to be part of the Nixon administration. And so he was willing to come to the table. He wanted to come to the table as a player. And the only way you do that is to bring something to play with. And he had his monetary policy. That's one thing. Does that sound right to you at all?
About correct, yeah, I would say. He did feel he was counselor to the president, more than chairman of the Fed.
And the other thing, which is much more speculative, except that I came to feeling this because there are so many letters from Burns to Nixon, exhorting Nixon to show leadership and telling Nixon in this almost biblical terminology that he has to be the one to lead the country out of its difficulties. In the environment of the time, people felt threatened. There was the civil rights movement, the middle class felt its values were threatened by hippies with the long hair and the demonstrations in the streets. People who lived through World War II thought that their patriotic feelings toward their country were being threatened by students in the street. There was a sense of impotence of why can't a world power lose? How can a world power lose to third world country in Southeast Asia? So in this kind of political environment, it was natural for someone to put together a coalition of people who were aggrieved. And Wallace was the first one to do that. And then with the inflation, there was this feeling that powerful forces were threatening your well-being, and the consumer thought it was greedy corporations, and businessmen thought it was labor out of control. So you had an environment where people like Connolly could put together political coalitions telling people that, yes, they were threatened, but you know, strong leadership is going to protect you, it's going to save you. We're going to deal with the people who are threatening you, whether it's the foreigners who were trading unfairly, or the labor unions, or greedy corporations. And Burns was caught up in that, and he thought Nixon could save the country through leadership. And this worked right together with Nixon's views of the importance of confidence and how strong government leadership would make people give the country a sense of self-confidence that would cause investment to continue to expand. And so Burns wanted to be in a close personal relationship with the president as a way of being the one that would inspire him to that leadership that would carry the country through. And it sounds crazy, but there are so many letters like that.
He didn't impress Nixon in part because he's so pompous. Yeah. Whereas Connolly was a very different kind of guy. Yeah. He charmed Nixon. Nixon wasn't an easy person to charm. Connolly was a Connolly clearly had, call it leadership qualities. People would follow him. Even Charles Walker, for example, the secretary of the real boss.
But Nixon was very politically astute, and so was Connolly. So there must have been that between them. We talked about the wage price controls and the devaluation, how to package government actions to show that you're in control, that you're doing something, that you're responding to this need to show leadership. But Burns, there was a naivete about it, and there are memos that kind of where Nixon is saying, well, you know, you don't learn this, and Burns is exhorting Nixon to establish a wage price review board to engage in jawboning, and Nixon is saying, well, they won't tell you this in Sunday school, but nobody's going to pay any attention to that. We can exhort people all we want, but people are going to do what's in their own self-interest. That wasn't his word. So Connolly must have seemed much more kind of politically realistic, had his feet in the ground to Nixon. Burns must have seemed...
And I guess Connolly had many of the qualities that Nixon wished he had as a human being, a purely personal. The man was a charmer, no question about it. In fact, I made the comment, I think it was to my wife, that he reminded me, in terms of charm, very much of Dickie Mountbatten. If Mountbatten had told me to go on... But it was a very touchy subject throughout. This whole international problem was quite touchy. I'll not forget just writing that report. We were down to just Herb Stein and myself on the council for a long time. And normally the council would write its report and send it around for comment to various departments involved. But this time, Paul, Bob Solomon of the Fed, actually came across and said, let's get this chapter right, just right. It's a very important chapter this year. And I said, yeah, I welcome your help. So everybody was very conscious at the end of 71 that the international had emerged as a problem. And that's where, I don't know, Schultz's arrival, Secretary of the Treasury, changed everything. Quite the whole attitude became very different. It became much more professional.
Well, Schultz was a marvelous economist to begin with. And he had a sense of integrity.
Yes, and tremendous sense of integrity.
And he could define issues and build a consensus. So he ultimately helped. Like, I guess the way Nixon got us out of the war, or Schultz got us out of the wage and price controls.
Yes.
Although it looked, in spring of 73, reading the memos and the letters coming from Congress, it looks as though we might have a wage price bureaucracy that stays with us forever. Inflation was high, food prices were rising dramatically. Seemed like an environment that how could you even think about getting wage and price controls? It looked like a defeatist attitude. Did you have that? I mean, this jumps ahead, but that's something that that my memos are that I've been able to see. They're very weak on is how we really got out from the wage and price controls when it looked like they might become a permanent part of the political landscape.
Yeah, my last conversation with the president was the day I was going to leave Washington. We threw a little breakfast in my honor, I guess. Three members of the council. Marina was now on the council, Marina Whitman.
This was 74?
No, this is 73. I left in March 73. Making it exactly 2 years that I'd taken leave from Stanford. And The president wanted to talk about beef prices.
Yes. Yes, I have.
That was the thing most in his mind, yes. Beef prices. Anyway, he was very talkative that morning, and Pat had to go off and open a rose garden or something. It was her birthday, 17th of March or something like that. And she went off, and Stein had to give a speech, and he excused himself. The president was still in a very exuberant, talkative mood.
He was already under pressure from Watergate.
Yes. And he said to me, okay, now, Dr. Solomon, sorry to see you go back to Stanford, but I admire the fact that you're keeping your word to the university. It's a great university and all that sort of stuff. Now, tell me, what is our biggest problem now? You poo-poo the beef business. And I said, Watergate. He said, what? I said, Watergate. Well, obviously, we'd been told by Haldeman that anybody mentions Watergate in front of the president, he'd have his testicles the next day. I mean, that was the command that came down from on high. So we spent another half hour with him telling me that Watergate wasn't a problem. And Haldeman came in and said, "Gotta get you out of here, Mr. President." Then John Dean came in. Apparently, the president had an appointment to see John Dean that day. That's when he learned, at least from the horse's mouth, that Watergate had become a very big problem. But I'm convinced that he didn't think it was a problem. Or why would he spend that much precious time with me? I mean, I was leaving that day, and who the hell was I anyway?
So what was... Nixon was such a capable person. Politically, he was... I guess this is Sapphire's word, sure-footed. And certainly in the international scene, he could act in a bold and decisive way. So what was the fatal flaw? A sense of paranoia? And
I would think so. And being misled by what I call slipper carriers. The old Burmese days, they used to be customer, the monarch would go to the pagoda, and of course he had to take his slippers off. But being the monarch, he'd handle slipper carriers to the slipper carrier. But the slipper carrier was a pretty senior guy. So he had his own slipper carrier. So when you talked about the royal entourage, you had to realize how many steps down you were getting orders from. I mean, whose slipper carrier was Chuck Colson? Obviously, Haldeman was Nixon's slipper carrier, and went all the way down to the deans, and all speaking in the name of the president. Combine that kind of extra dedication. I'd walk over my mother's grave if the president asked me to do that. I guess they got the idea that we can please Mr. Nixon. That was my interpretation, that he got suckered into.
Person at the top can become very isolated. It's very easy to become surrounded by people who tell you what you want to hear. Because
absolutely,
the people who want your status is defined by your access to the president. And the people who compete for access to the president are the ones who want that sort of status. And they tend to be people who say whatever they need to say to get in that kind of
what surprised me is that he went along with this. I mean, either chutzpah or... Because almost every time I gave him quote, whatever it was called, advice, he would always say, let me think, what do we gain, what do we lose? Most of the contacts with him had very little to do with macroeconomics. Had to do with, for example, crop shortages, why don't we free this acreage?
Sure.
You know?
Right.
And I happen to be chairman of that committee.
Mm-hmm.
So I suggested, my view is just free all acreage, no more acreage restrictions whatsoever. And the president said, I think it's a good idea. What are we going to lose? What are we going to gain? You know? how many votes are you losing and gaining all the time? Mm-hmm. What are the risks? Then he said to me, you tell Earl Butz. I said, no, sir, you tell Earl Butz. I'm not going to tell Earl Butz. But I was surprised that he didn't do the same thing when he was confronted with the idea of breaking into Washington. He didn't say, what have we got to gain compared to what we might have to lose? The gain was obviously trivial.
But that's where the sense of isolation must come in. And the person at the top doesn't say, he doesn't say, you break into Watergate. He says, you know, we have problems here, there are people who wish us ill. You deal with that problem. So, and then later on, you get problems that, well, you know, well, we'll take care of them. You get in deeper and deeper, and the people at the top don't want to go to Nixon and say, gee, you know, I misled you, you know, you can have my hand. So pretty soon you're in too far to get back, and nobody's there to, like with the crop acreage, just to lay out, like an economist does, is lay out hard options and let you think about what the trade-offs are, what the choices are. You're only having people there telling you, well, you know, this is what you can do to get through. But it's, I think it's too bad. I think Nixon is caricatured now because people have trouble thinking about a complex individual. So you're either successful or you're not, and if you're not successful, then, you know, everything is, your view of somebody's colored by that. So, well, you know, you have to be clumsy and incompetent, but that's, you know, it wasn't that way at all.
No, he was a remarkable person in the sense that his apparent phoniness and dishonesty increased as the square of the audience. One-on-one, there was never any reason to think of him as dishonest in the sense that he appeared when mm-hmm. the whole country was watching him on TV. You have to say, believe me, would I lie to you, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Very unsure. Here again, his sycophants would not let anybody comment on the fact that maybe the president didn't come through so well. You know, we used to watch his speeches, and one way you do is comment on it. Can't say anything about delivery, only about part.
That's again, funny, because I remember watching the Nixon-Kennedy debate in 1960, and he lost the election because he came in looking so haggard. Sure. You know, he needed somebody to
tell him that. And certainly by 1970,
he should have known.
You have some lessons.
Maybe Pat should have been the one. That's more forceful with him. In terms of the president weighing off costs and benefits of economic programs, when he was thinking about wage and price controls, I know from the memos this came up very clearly in November and December of 1970, because when the decision was made that GNP was going to grow too slowly to move the unemployment rate down significantly by summer 1972, and the decision was made to go for higher GNP growth. You know, the issue came up with how to deal with the Fed, and when Burns felt that he had more leverage, then he restarted his campaign for an incomes policy. He must have had the sense that, you know, I have something that they want. Okay, and then so Burns gives his speech at Pepperdine College, and goes public numerous times before congressional committees in a way that must have been considered very provocative by the Nixon people. So early on, there are discussions of wage incomes policies, and as I mentioned, Nixon comes across as very skeptical of anything short of wage price controls. He thinks people would just ignore the government. So that must have been one factor. But how important was the concern of the Nixon administration for labor in their negative reaction. Was that a factor in putting off the decision?
You know, I had little to do with that. Mm-hmm. I used to hear Burns mentioning the phrase infants policy. A good source of that might be, have you seen George Shorts' book on the subject?
The book he wrote with Dan?
Yeah, not that. He wrote another one with someone else on incomes policies.
But wasn't that an earlier something in the 1960s?
It was guidelines. After guidelines or guideposts or something
but
like
that. But that was in 66.
Yeah, but this reflects his view. Right. And he never changed his views about that.
Mm-hmm.
He was very close to Labor. I think he's the only Secretary of Labor that George Kennedy
trusted.
Yeah,
well, I need to talk to him. Some of the unions supported Nixon, didn't they?
Yes, Teamsters particularly.
What about the construction unions?
No,
were
not the construction unions. No. As far as
it was mainly the Teamsters.
Mainly the Teamsters.
Mm-hmm. But I hadn't.
He was very welcome in the White House, whatever his name is.
Hoffa.
No, not Hoffa. The successor. Hoffa's successor, Irish name.
Yeah, Hoffa. Okay. Let me go through some of my notes if I can. So these start before you, but the Nixon administration, the economic policies, they went through a cycle. There was gradualism. And then 1065, which is we need to grow faster, and then there was kind of go for growth with the controls. And then in 73, it was more steady as she goes, let's try to maintain some real growth and hope inflation comes down and so on. And then you go back to gradualism, you go back to the original policy. Maybe we could go through each of those a little bit. I mean, the council told Nixon basically that they could bring the inflation rate down, and inflation would, they thought full employment was 4% unemployment, and that you'd have some rise in unemployment above that, maybe to 4.5%, but it really wouldn't go much above that.
No, I don't know what happened early on, but I do know I got into big trouble with Bill Proxmire when I suggested in December 1972, that the rate, the equilibrium rate of unemployment was now 4.9.
So this was in December of 72?
December 72, at hearings before the Joint Economic Committee. He was chairman at that time. All my calculations had shown that if 4 had been correct in 1965, it was promulgated. Come on high.
Yeah.
Then due to structural changes, it was 4.9.
I get the feeling that...
he gave me hell for that.
Proxmire. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was very political. He would... Later on, when... in 74 especially, when inflation was so obviously out of control, then he attacked the Fed for high money growth. But at this time, he was pushing Burns as being catalyst.
Yes, he was pushing the 3% unemployment target. I said to him, why not zero, for God's sake? You're going to be pious. Let's go the whole way. And he said, don't be foolish.
There's a memo very early on from Herb Stein to the president where he talks about the unemployment rate, and he says, look, the demographics are changing. You're getting, first of all, you're getting very high rates of growth of labor as women enter the labor force. And you're also getting a changing demographic composition. You're getting younger workers and you're getting more female workers. The unemployment rate may be higher. And then there's a very sharp political reaction that, oh, the Republicans are insensitive to the unemployment of women, they're insensitive to the unemployment of minorities. and so on and so on. So I had the feeling that the word must have come down that you can't talk this way because it suggests an insensitivity to, as I say, women and minorities and so on. So that it was really off limits to talk about a changing natural rate of interest. And for political reasons, you couldn't go around and say, well, it's 5% now.
Yeah, there was some feeling on the part that it's not a nice thing to say, but damn it, the function of an economist in the council is to call it as he sees it. And,
but the council never challenged Nixon on his assumption that we needed 4% unemployment. Now they're talking about getting. You know, they're realistic. They're talking about getting unemployment down to, you know, 5% by the summer of 1972. But there's never any memo saying, you know, this is the wrong target. Because when Nixon comes into office, unemployment is 3.5%.
Yeah, that was wartime.
Right. But they're... It does seem as though the council throughout this period accepts Nixon's target for what employment should be by 72. And of course, I mean, Nixon's the boss, so I suppose that's...
I don't think the council accepted it. I certainly didn't. And neither, you know, I testify in... Mm-hmm. In public, in front of the only congressional committee.
Yeah.
I was the only person on the council for a while, as you know. Herbert lost an eye or something like that.
I didn't know that. So that was... Proxmire was on the...
But no, the 72 occasion when I was talking about 4.9 being full employment, no, Herb was there, but he didn't say anything against my doing that. Maybe by then inflation had begun to really start. I mean, the big inflation of 73-74 had begun by December 72.
And I gather wholesale price index, food prices and certain things started to move up. But
long before the oil crisis.
Oh, yeah.
Long before.
Sure. And that's in your book, of course. But even at this point, Burns is very much wedded to controls. Sapphire talks about a meeting, and this is in memos, too, about setting the target for inflation for 1973. And Burns says, you know, we should set the target from 1% to 2%. And everybody else is saying that's completely unrealistic. And then in early 73, you get an enormous amount of intervention by the Federal Reserve System in financial markets, because as inflation goes up, interest rates start to go up, and Burns wants an extension of the Economic Stabilization Act. He doesn't want interest rates to go up. He feels like what's going to keep inflation down is the controls on wages. And if interest rates go up, the feeling that there's a shared sacrifice, that everybody is sacrificing to make the program work, but that'll be gone and labor won't support it. So monetary policy continues to be very expansionary in early 73. You get all this business about the two-tier prime and keeping the interest rates for small businessmen low, and those rates fall well below the prime rate. So Burns seems still very much wedded to the idea of controls well into 73.
It was fashionable, I guess, after Vietnam to think in terms of it's a different kind of inflation. It's modern inflation. It cannot be controlled entirely by monetary policy. You do need some help.
But
guidelines, guideposts.
But McCracken certainly came to that view. And
as I say, it was fashionable.
Yeah, Stein seems to be more agnostic about it. He doesn't ever express that view that inflation is caused by monopoly power or labor
wage push.
Yeah, but he's in charge of the controls program, and so at least initially, so he's kind of very pragmatic. Well, here we are. You know, we're going to use them. It's in the summer of 73 that he and Schultz become concerned that the controls might go on forever and begin to work very hard to try to... the idea is always that they're going to be temporary, that they'll be removed. But I get the feeling by the summer of 73 that there's a concern that the parts of the controls will become permanent. Of course, in energy and hospital controls, they did stay around for a long time. But rent controls especially seem to be an area where it looks like you're going to get a permanent national program to control rents. And it seems like at that point that they begin to push very hard to get some commitment to phase the controls out permanently.
But it's more Schultz than Stein, in my thought. I left by then. Judging the two men before.
Yeah, well, that's where my memos, that's my impression too, and that's where my memos are weak. And unfortunately, George Schultz is not yet ready to open his memoranda to the public yet. They're at the Hoover Institute. His papers,
yes.
His Nixon-era papers. And I had talked to him, and he said he was willing for me to look at them. And then I called the Hoover Institute, and they said, no, we can't show them to just one person.
I see.
They have to be open to everybody. And so unfortunately, he's not ready to do that. Although there's so many things coming out now that Nixon has died, from Burns's paper at Ann Arbor and from the National Archives, that I would hope that he'd be willing to get his...
When did he become secretary? Time just gets all confused. When exactly did he become secretary of the Treasury?
Well, when Connally left to take charge of the re-election committee for Nixon, so that would have been early 72.
Early 72?
Well, the election was in November of 72.
Yeah.
And Connally leaves to take charge of the re-election campaign. And so he did that early on in 72. And so that's when Schultz goes from Normandy to Treasury.
Certainly in early 73, he was really talking seriously about it. Float the dollar, stop hands-on policy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just mumbling to himself and to close friends and so on, getting absurd. It was very funny. We moved from fixed exchange rates to a float as of, it happened automatically. Nobody sort of did anything.
Mm-hmm.
And one minute it's perfectly legal to prop the other guy's currency up, and the next minute it's totally illegal. It happened fast. It was dawning on the whole world. Absurd situation.
But it wasn't part of an entire strategy. It didn't go along with the strategy for determining the U.S. price level in a monetary way. So it was a partial, without the Federal Reserve System, it was a partial strategy. So I think, as Friedman would have said, it was a necessary condition for a sensible domestic monetary policy, but it was not a sufficient condition.
Now, Milton was very close to the scene via Schultz.
Yes, and at certain times, especially in fall of 1971, when M1 stopped growing. With the announcement of the wage and price controls, there was a fall in inflationary expectations, and the Fed was pegging the funds rate, I think it was 5.5%. So with that fall in inflationary expectations, the real rate of interest rose, which required a monetary deceleration, so that for quite a period of time you got no money growth. And there are some very strong letters from Friedman to Schultz complaining about the lack of money growth, and then Schultz complaining to the White House, to Nixon, and then Nixon writing really amazing letters to Burns. And this is the period where there's so much internal dissension within the Federal Open Market Committee, because the Federal Open Market Committee had always, had still basically was looking at interest rates, and they were willing to move interest rates down, but they were not willing to move them down very sharply. Their projections were that money growth would begin to rise. M2 growth had already risen, and to say there, and there was also been a feeling that, well, once, if you move interest rates down very, very sharply, it becomes hard to move back up again for political reasons. And it was at this period where Burns basically just hijacked monetary policy in a very high-handed way, just pushed through his policies on the committee. And one example, the meeting in January 1972, it was scheduled for the end of January, and this was the period where M1 growth was still very low, although the staff was forecasting that it would rise, and it was moving up. It moved up to about 2%, but Burns scheduled a special FOMC meeting for earlier in January to get money growth up, to push interest rates down even more sharply. And the meeting came right after the Smithsonian Accord. And of course, with the Smithsonian Accord, the idea was that we would get a capital influx back into the United States to offset the capital outflow. But U.S. interest rates were, Burns wanted to push U.S. interest rates down below foreign levels. And so Hayes in New York and staff people like Bob Solomon were against a dramatic reduction in interest rates. And Burns wouldn't even, FOMC meetings always started off with an international discussion. Forever they had done that. And Burns wouldn't even let the committee discuss the Smithsonian Accord or any of the international ramifications of it. He said, we're here to discuss domestic monetary policy. And the committee wouldn't, there were two directives, an A and a B directive, and B is what Burns wanted, and A is what the committee wanted. So Burns said, okay, you want A, fine, I'll give you A, but we're going to change the language to make it read like B. So there was a lot. Anyways, so this was a difficult time for the Fed. Burns was very kind of tyrannical in the way he ran. You know, kind of ran things very kind of abusive to people. He was not a great, unless you were a natural follower. And certainly the Fed had a lot of those people, like Richmond's president at the time. You know, he was not a great, favorite. You know, he did not lead, through a sense, like Greenspan, through a sense of collegiality. Anyway, so, did you know Art Laffer?
Yes.
You know, the 1065 business. So, in late 1970, the projections for GMP made it pretty clear you weren't going to get a reduction in unemployment. And Laffer was working for Schultz at OMB at the time, so they figured out, well, what GMP target do we need to get a reduction in unemployment? And then Laffer was the one who told them, well, this is the amount of money growth you need. You remember that?
Yeah. I can't understand how he got away with that, you know. The OMB economist is really the sort of junior guy. This is Troika 2 level at which these things are done, and Troika One accepts them. But the chairman of Troika Two is the guy from the council. That was Herb Stein, I think, before I went there. And Chuck Barty was the man from the Fed.
Yes, he was Burns' confidant. Slippery carrier.
And how in hell they let OMB get away with its private forecast? I'll never know. It was ridiculous.
I was a student at Chicago at the time, and the paper floated around Chicago, and everybody was looking at it amazedly because it was simply a regression of money. It was a regression of nominal GNP on money, except neither series was seasonally adjusted. And there's an incredible amount of seasonality in money and GNP. So all the kick was from the seasonal, and the students were scratching their heads, and this is how policy is done.
I can understand Art Lapper doing that. I mean, Art was a student of mine.
Yeah.
Chuck Barty had been a student of mine. So I know them both well, but he's a serious sort of guy. He's not going to let some clown get away with something ridiculous.
Party.
But yet they did. Oh, we may let Burns tell him what to do, but at the Troika level, Quadriad 2 or some such name to it. Ed Fiedler, I think, was the guy from Treasury. I'm not certain. But anyway, that 1066 business was really terrible. George sort of believed Locke. You know, he's not a quantitative economist, and someone showed him an equation and a regression and said, this is the case, and he'd go for it.
Well, the council seemed to be looking at the St. Louis equations a lot, the regressions under Anderson and Jordan, and so I suppose they thought they were in that line of regression. But you had Chuck Barty as a student?
Yeah, back in Chicago.
I didn't know that. I have talked to him. He was the consummate insider. He was very, very close to Burns.
Yes.
And he's the only person I've talked to that I really had to cajole. He was very suspicious, and I know that he would not have talked to me if I had not been from the Fed. But I've not talked to him about the Burns period. I talked to him about the Martin period.
I see.
And so I'm going to call him back. He was a very effective governor. Because he really knew how to use the FOMC agenda and format, and he could talk about the economy and present both views, sound very reasonable, and then say, well, this is where I come out, and be very convincing, but it was always for a more expansionary policy. He was very concerned about housing, very concerned about unemployment, very kind of Keynesian expansionist. I encourage you to be responsible for that.
I was the only guy in Chicago who would spend a good part of the money and banking course on Keynes. I thought it was a very, very important chapter in economic history, and it's history of thought.
Well, but this was his sense of, well, it wasn't history of thought, yeah. But this was his priorities. He thought that government ought to do something for housing, keep interest rates down, and stimulate economic activity. So when was Partee at Chicago?
I thought there between 48 and 60 and sometime in that time frame.
Oh, so you must have had Axelrod, too.
I remember him.
He was at Chicago, and he was at the business school. But he was very a high staff. Steve Axelrod.
I know him.
Yeah. I've not talked to him yet. I have his phone number, and I will. I'm interested in him. Okay. Did you have contact with Arthur Burns in meetings, a personal contact with him at all?
No. Mm-hmm. Well, we met, as I said, for luncheon once a month. Mm-hmm. Council would go over to the Fed. Very little shocked off, actually.
Yes.
Yes.
He seems to be
keeping in touch.
He wants to. In the Martin era, it was very easy for board members, especially, to talk with members of the council. The relations were close at all levels. But Burns always wanted everything to go through him. And he was very cagey about monetary policy. I mean, I have the feeling that his leverage came from his control over money. So if he ever committed himself, he would lose that leverage. So I have the feeling he never said, okay, you know, you want 6% money growth, I'll give you 6% money growth. And I don't think it was because he, believed somehow abstractly in Fed independence. I think it was more that was his source of leverage. And although once he got what he wanted, which is the controls, you know, Camp David, he really was committed, because he'd gotten everything he wanted, and then he had to, there was no way he could then not follow an expansionary monetary policy. But he seems to, despite all his sense of sophistication and his experience in Washington, he seems to have been manipulated. I mean, on the one hand, he was very tough in fighting for what he wanted. In 71, he wanted tax reductions in the administration. He wanted to get Social Security increases. He wanted investment tax credit. Of course, he wanted elimination of the Davis-Bacon Act, crackdown on the construction industries. So when looking at this period, when he felt like he was being excluded, when his views weren't being listened to, he had no compunction about going public, giving speeches, talking before congressional committees, and saying things that Democrats wanted to hear, that they could use as ammunition against the Republicans, so he could be very effective in public in needling the administration. And then the administration would need him, but they could, despite all his Burns' sophistication, they could manipulate him. They could say, okay, you know, you will represent us at this international conference, and we'll take your advice on these international issues, and he would come back and want to be part of the administration again, so that whenever the administration really needed him, it's like he was, you know, he was there. And ultimately, Burns' thought leadership and confidence and fiscal policy interventions were the most important. Stein and the council thought monetary policy was the most important, so they needed each other, and they would kind of warily circle around each other, and ultimately each got what they wanted. Stein and Nixon got an expansionary monetary policy, and Burns got all kinds of fiscal measures, and ultimately wage price controls, and the country got inflation.
Lots of inflation.
Oh, gee, it's ironic how many good people the Nixon administration had as economists, and how badly things turned out. But I think when you write the history of this period, you have to, it's like the Civil War, when everything goes back to slavery. And in this period, everything goes back to the war. And the war had created such...
Vietnam, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Such a poisonous political environment, and such divisions, and such an environment where kind of people felt, as we talked about the politics of scapegoating, that not a, you know, we think the political environment today is difficult and the problems are difficult. They were really, the country was in real danger.
I remember the convention of 72, someone in Florida, I think.
Yeah, I think nobody wanted to repeat Chicago 68, so I think it was probably, I think Miami was probably
safe.
It was a safe city. They wouldn't have it there today, but...
Although, even then they had threats of students or someone marching on the convention, there was a lot of security.
I'm sorry, did I interrupt you? In terms of individuals, there are quite a few kind of, as I say, this gets back, there seems to be advice coming from so many different sources. Peter Flanagan writes memos that are really kind of quite intelligent and quite well.
He was sort of the economics man. There was quite a trio of them. There was von Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Peter were a notch below the other two. In a sense, Peter sort of reported to the two of them, or reported to them. But he was the brightest in terms of economics.
And he seems pretty in the Schultz-Friedman free market. Mm-hmm. View, and he seemed to have kept his free market views much longer than others, when even after the feeling that labor unions were sabotaging the recovery. You wouldn't have his address, would you? You haven't kept contact with him?
No, I've lost contact completely. I think maybe not with my name. I'm not sure.
I have some idea. Somebody said he was on the board of a bank. So I have some.
Well, I'm sure he's on the board of a bank.
Well, yeah, but they had the name of the bank. So I have some clues, but I don't know where.
His dad was chairman of manufacturers for a long time.
Oh.
The old man's dead now.
Yeah, but there might be some. Maybe the son's on the board there. Because he would be an interesting person to talk to.
Yes, he'd sit in on many, many meetings and sort of keep notes for the president, essentially.
Marina Whitman is retired now, I assume.
Marina is, she's retired. She went to General Motors for many, many years. Then, I think she's still at Ann Arbor. She's teaching at Ann Arbor.
Oh, okay. So then Paul McCracken would know how to get a hold of Marina.
Yes.
Okay, so I can do that. What about some of the more junior people? Cole, C-O-L-E, what was his first name?
Ray? No. Colson, I remember well.
Colson. You do remember Colson. I'm... In July. I've not yet read through his diary, but I have it on CD-ROM. It's indexed, so I'm
for
definitely...
sure a compulsive guy. And he used to administer one time, and it has nothing to do with monetary policy, but it shows the kind of guy he is. Say Stein had. One eye went to hell within him.
Yeah,
it broke or something. It was a strange thing, the pressure, and blinded in one eye. And the doctor called me and said, this guy has to stay in bed, dying to come to work.
So when was this?
This was just about the time we were writing the report for the year 72. It was therefore January 72.
Mm-hmm.
McCracken had left in December 71, I think. And then this happened to her. And the rules were that the chairman of the council had the right to be picked up by a White House car. But not the two members. The two members could use a White House car, but not to their homes. You could order it to come next door, but not to the house. So when Herb was getting very agitated and demanding to come in, I called up Haldeman's office and said, you've got to make an exception, you know. And he's de facto chairman. You're going to make him chairman within a few weeks. Mm-hmm. So for God's sake, stop being petty. Send him a car to his house. He'll go blind otherwise. He shouldn't drive his own car. He said, no.
Because he felt that would just upset the status
yes.
of things and make Stein more important than he really was.
Whereas within a week he's going to become chairman and then he can have the car. There was that kind of pettiness that struck me as being stupid. But Ehrlichman, I saw a lot of, and I thought he was an intelligent fellow. Although occasionally he would try to dissuade me from things that I was going to suggest. And I refused to be dissuaded.
And these had to do, for example, as you mentioned, there was the perception that if the controls were going to work, labor had to go along with it. You had to keep wage rates down, but if food prices kept going up, you couldn't get that support. So the council was suggesting things like increasing, getting rid of the acreage limit. So that would have been the kind of thing that
exactly.
He would have said, well, you know, that's too, you know, too political.
He would say, my stomach tells me that that's wrong. He's a conciliatory fellow. He'd say, I can see why you're saying that, I can see why it's probably correct, but my stomach tells me, meaning politically it's not good. But Flanagan was the economic guy. Well, Ehrlichman had the title of domestic policy in food economics. And Ehrlichman had his Haldeman had his Ehrlichman, and if you get what I mean, there were a lot of second level people there.
Too. Well, you see that within the Federal Reserve System, too. It's some people are leaders and some people are followers, and there aren't very many leaders. There are only a few, and it's clear, you know, it's well established who the leader is. And if you challenge the leader is a very lonely thing, because nobody's going to support you. That's the kind of environment, and people are secure enough of themselves to do so, partly because to get to the kind of position of importance, you spend most of your time doing administrative things, making things run, making things work, seeing that things get done. So when it comes to challenging the leader, talking about issues, it takes a lot of self-confidence and kind of a lot of ability to talk and articulate ideas that you don't naturally have. So it's very hard. It's just there's this logic to follow the leader that's very hard to do something about. And if you do, you're lonely and you make other people feel uncomfortable. They don't know quite how to deal with you. So it's not an easy. It's not an easy thing. The logic in this situation was to, even though there was a lot of unhappiness with Burns, so hard to deal with him. In an FOMC meeting, you might disagree with him, but this guy, he could start talking about the behavior of inventories in the business cycle in 1870, and come through to the beginning. And, you know, how could you challenge a guy like that without feeling stupid? And he would make you feel stupid. I mean, he had no compunction about being abusive or condescending. people. So didn't challenge him lightly. And then, of course, you had a whole set of staff people, some of whom were very good, but some of whom were there because they were serving the chairman. So.
And he was a pompous man. Probably the pompous man in the proper. Squeaky voice with that pipe in his mouth. And as you say, he pontificated him this morning. What did you think he controlled interest rates? He can't control interest rates. You know, that's the bad answer.
Yeah.
I hope this has been helpful, Robert. I